The D flat major nocturne of Frédéric Chopin, Opus 27, number 2, in an absolutely, to my ears, exquisite recording from 1993 in Manhattan by our guest last week and again this week, Charles Rosen, one of the preeminent pianists, scholars, commentators, critics, conversationalists of our time. Charles Rosen has been our guest as he travels about to commemorate his 80th year. And he is doing so with recitals, lectures. I'm sure some publications and so on will be coming around the bend or the corner. Charles Rosen, scholarship is a big topic. It's a big area. It has many sides to it. But Chopin is an example of where some of the good sides of scholarship have actually helped us to get to the Chopin who was, the versions that he wanted us to hear. Even though he lived a brief life, he was changing, correcting, revisiting pieces throughout that life.
Yeah, well, he did change the dynamics in this in a couple of pupils' copies. And for the better, there was the last playing of the theme was originally pianissimo, and the cadenza after it was fortissimo, and then he changed it around. So you have the triumphal performance of the theme, and then a sudden descent on a new harmony, which is magical, and you play the whole cadenza pianissimo instead of fortissimo. It's much more beautiful. Yeah, is that? But that's not my scholarship. That
right.
was discovered by other people.
No, no. But I just mean that there's a combination in your life as a scholar, but also you have to sort through the scholarship of others and find what is the scholarship that actually helps you as a player.
Yeah, well, I think we all do that. But it's the I've always been interested in that's the sort of scholarship in that sense. There's a problem about performance is that. We're playing on instruments that are different from the instruments the composers like Beethoven, Chopin, even Debussy had. The problem is that if you start playing on the instruments that they used and you're playing in a hall that seats more than about 500 people, then it doesn't work. You can't really play them. And you need slightly different instruments for the larger halls, and that. The only thing is that it's a good idea to know what the music sounded like on those old instruments to see how much of it can be reproduced on a modern instrument.
Mm-hmm.
And
mm-hmm.
I know I had this, the funniest example was the Beethoven Moonlight Sonata, which I recorded in that Beethoven tells you to put your pedal down at the beginning of the first movement and not to let it up, which you can't possibly do that on a modern Steinway.
Mm-hmm.
And so I worked it out. I tried it on one of the old pianos. From maybe a bit too late, I used a piano from 1811 or 12. And it sounded a bit blurred to me, so I thought, but just very slightly, so I decided to work it out on the modern piano to be just a little bit, instead of that resonant blurring, which is what he wanted, gave him that sort of romantic effect for the Moonlight Sonata. And then, so I went and recorded, and that was actually rather funny. I had a great engineer, Max Wilcox, who's fabulous. But I mean, he was. This one case, which I hope he doesn't mind my telling this story, is that I made four takes because it's very difficult to get the pedal to come just right. A pedal is different on every piano, and of course you have to work it out so that you get just the blurring you want, and not more. And finally, the fourth take, I said, "It's fine. We can just print that." And then when I got the record, the test pressing, it seemed to me quite wrong. And I said, "Max, it's not what I did." He said, "Well, it was a little blurred in spots." So I said, "I'll put it back." No, I mean, it was quite funny. Because the thing about it is Max did all those great recordings with Arthur Rubinstein, who expected Max to clean up anything
exactly.
that he had.
I almost imagine in my head somebody going into the Impressionist galleries at the Art Institute and cleaning up the Monets or something and saying there was some blur there.
Yeah,
you know?
No, right? He's a very great, greatest record producer that I ever worked with, and still did quite fabulous, and we did quite a lot together.
What types of pianos do you own and play?
Well, I have an old Steinway at home, which was built in 1939. And somebody tells me it was one of the last instruments where the mechanism was actually signed by the worker, because they used to have one man make the piano and the whole right. mechanics of what you put in the piano. After that, it came on the assembly line, like right. a Ford car, so that it wasn't sized anymore. But I have that. And in Paris, where I have a very small apartment, just so a place, a studio, to practice in between concerts in different countries. Because, I mean, if I had to pay not only hotel bills, but I had to rent a studio for practice, it's prohibitive. So I actually have an old Steinway upright, but they really? Don't build them. It was huge. Yeah. It was very tall and yeah. big sound. Mine was built in 1914.
Wow.
And it has a beautiful sound. So
yeah.
I use that. And that's basically the instrument. But I mean, that is a beautiful piano I play on in New York in public concerts and recorded on, which is owned by a wonderful technician called Mary Schwenderman, and she sort of rebuilt the Steinway.
Well, that's the Steinway D that you've made.
The Steinway D, but yeah. a lot of people, Richard Good plays it,
yes.
and Andre Watts plays it, and I play it.
Right.
When we get it, that's...
Yeah, well, that's kind of, it's sort of a library of a piano for a select group of pianists to check out. Let's talk a bit more about Chopin and perhaps Chopin in historic context. You have looked at his music in pure musicological terms, and you've also looked at Chopin in his time in your book, The Romantic Generation. You've looked at a special period in history.
Well, the funny thing, you know, you seem occasionally, when you write something, to try and correct the misunderstandings. The fact is that the misunderstandings are not nearly as widespread as one thinks. That is, I mean, they used to write in a sort of popular way about Chopin is that he was a miniaturist and so on. Well, I mean, most pianists know that the great B minor sonata and the B flat minor sonata and the scherzis and the ballades
right.
and the barcarolle and the Polonaise fantasy and the big F sharp minor, they're some of the greatest long pieces ever written. In fact, mm-hmm. all of those are longer than the average movement by Beethoven and... they're all absolutely perfect. I mean, Chopin, in fact, was the only composer of his generation who wrote big, long pieces without any problem. Schumann used to have problems. I mean, Schumann, some of the long pieces come out wonderfully, and others have beautiful things in them but are a little awkward to play. There's nothing awkward about a Chopin form. There's very often something awkward about the writing because Chopin was absolutely ruthless. He didn't care what position he put your hand in. Is that made you do really terrible stretching problems in Chopin. I mean, so on. So, I mean, in a way, I was what might be called, I was when writing about Chopin, I was trying to correct what might be called a popular misunderstanding, but I have no illusions that I was correcting the understanding of most pianists and musicians who knew perfectly well that what I was saying was right. I mean, I wasn't really mm-hmm. being that original. But
you
I
were
think
bringing
were
the pianist's insight
that,
to
yes.
the general public
yeah.
or to the historical public.
I did
public.
Go further than some, pointing out that Chopin's voice leading, that is, what he considered counterpoint, that he was probably the greatest master since the death of Mozart. Mm-hmm. And one doesn't think of Chopin that way, but right. he himself did, so I did think. But once again, what I was basing that on was it's my experience of the music, and above all, my experience as well of performers. That I used to hear pianists like Joseph Hoffman and others in the past, and they would always bring out inner voices in Chopin. We all knew they were there. Mm-hmm. But of course, if you have inner voices, you're a great contrapuntist if it works very well.
Right.
The difference between Chopin and Schumann is that the counterpoint in Chopin is absolutely academically correct. Mm-hmm. Is that you always have four voices. Schumann was a much more modern composer than Chopin in that way, that he really conceived music not as a sort of a four-voice score coming, but like a piano sound, I mean, where you really have all the voices blurred together. And in many cases in Schumann, voices appear from nowhere and disappear, whereas in Chopin, they always come from somewhere and you know just where they're going. So I mean that. Mm. But Schumann is a more pianistic, more modern artist. Well, that leads much closer to Debussy than Chopin does. Where Chopin leads in revolutionary writing is in his harmony, which goes directly into Wagner. That's where Wagner got it, because Liszt used to play Chopin to him. And that's and Chopin, an enormous influence on composers that of following up all the way through Debussy and basically and so on. So, I mean, that's quite important in that.
One of the things that I think has made the classical style and then the Romantic generation, as well as many of your other writings, so effective and so important for so many people is that you have a way of combining great learning and great learnedness with common sense. And they don't always go hand in hand in the academic world.
Well, it's very nice of you to say so. I never thought of myself as having common sense, but I'm nice.
Well, you do as a writer. Yes, I don't know about it in the rest of your life.
Great.
But I mean, seriously, you bring experience in to the picture as a pianist that enables you to sort some things out, I think.
Well, I've only written about music that I enjoyed. So, mm-hmm. I mean, that's if there is a secret, it's that, which, I mean, the idea of if I don't think you can understand music that doesn't give you pleasure. I mean, mm-hmm. If it doesn't give you any pleasure and you don't know why it gives somebody else pleasure,
right.
At least you may not like it, but at least if you know why somebody else likes it, you might be able to say something about it. But you're best writing about music that gives you enormous pleasure yourself, because then you sort of have a kind of intimate experience of it and you'll be able to talk about it.
I wonder if there might be two or three articles or books that you have read about music that does not give you pleasure, but written by someone for whom it did give pleasure, and that you at least got some insight as to why that person liked composer X, Y, or Z.
No, because if I'm really convinced by it, the books, then I do start getting pleasure from the music.
Right,
itself.
But I mean, is there somebody that you did come around to because of the advocacy?
Well, there was a famous article by Manfred Buchhofzer that on Johannes Ockeghem of the 15th century, where he really showed why Ockeghem was really fascinating. And then you go back to the music and suddenly it's like having a veil lifted from it. And you know, I mean, there are great, great writers on music. Tovey has done that for a lot of people. And there are even passages of Bernard Shaw that... It's a great thing Bernard Shaw about Richard Strauss, where he once said that the problem of listening to Strauss is that he's gone beyond having passing tones, what he has are passing phrases. In other words, that there'll be not just a note which is dissonant to the thing, but a whole phrase which is dissonant to the main thing. Which I don't know whether Shaw invented that or he got that from some musician.
But it's a very interesting insight, isn't it?
But that shows that, you know, a good critic is the one who knows the people that will tell him something interesting.
Are you working on any writing projects now?
No, well, I gave some lectures at short lectures at Indiana, which have to be written down on the representation of sentiment in music. In the, I've said I would publish that. And that.
Can you give us an example of one of the points that you
it's hard to give an example because, first of all, I'd have to play.
Okay.
And second of all, that I've said in the book that I'm not going to identify which sentiments are being represented because it's always clear. You don't need to be told.
Interesting.
I'm interested in is the structure, but I'm mainly interested in the use of melodies by Mozart and Beethoven which have contradictory sentiments in the melody itself that I'm into, which is... What I'm interested in was that you have these, I can give you an example, which is the beginning of the Jupiter Symphony has two entirely different emotions in the opening phrase and very contrasting, which are then resolved later. And what I'm interested in is that this kind of melody with some kind of contradiction or some kind of opposition completely disappears from music about 30 years later. That is, they're not a single melody of Chopin, Schumann, Liszt, or so on, which has any kind of opposition within the melody itself.
And why is that?
That's very complicated.
Okay.
Please go on that.
But it has to do with a different goal, right?
Yeah, I mean, they're looking at music in a different way.
Right.
And that's, if I have to, you know, I was interested in that kind of change that happened in music around during Beethoven's lifetime. And you have arguments of people... have attacked me because I treat Beethoven as a classical composer, although I know, but Jens Peter Larsen, who's the great authority on Haydn, attacked me saying you can't possibly put Beethoven along with Haydn and Mozart because he's much louder, which is absolutely true. Beethoven is much louder.
Right, but that doesn't have to do with structure.
Yeah, but, well, I mean, my feeling is, I'm not idiotic. I know that the whole emotion in Beethoven is very different from the music, the emotion in Mozart and Haydn, much more violent, much more explosive. The only thing is that there are certain technical aspects of music that disappear after Beethoven with Schumann, for example, and Chopin. I mean, for example, the absolute opposition between dominant and subdominant, which is in Haydn and Mozart and retains in Beethoven, disappears completely from music. Mm-hmm. In other words, that you can modulate going in the sharp direction going up, mm-hmm. or you can modulate in the flat direction going down the fifths. Mm-hmm. And for Beethoven, this was entirely different. Mm-hmm. And Chopin doesn't make any distinction about that. And that's what really changes music. You start getting into this very chromatic music with Chopin and Schumann and with Wagner and finally ending up with Schoenberg and so on. And Beethoven never goes anywhere near that. In fact, when they asked him about another contemporary composer, is that Spohr, he said, it's too dissonant. Mm. And basically what he meant probably is that Spohr is chromatic. Is
right.
That
right.
He has this kind of chromaticism which doesn't resolve, whereas Beethoven always resolves the way Haydn and Mozart does. Beethoven expanded music beyond anybody's experience, but he didn't actually change the basis of it.
Right.
Chopin actually changed the basis of the way music is written and ended up by destroying tonality. And that's what leads to that terrible mess that people call modernism.
We're going to go out with a major work of Schumann's, but I'd like you to say something about the recording that we're going to hear, because I believe it has some there's some unique aspects to the version that you're playing here.
Well, I was made a whole series of Schumann recordings, and that was done in Holland, in Harlem. Actually, it's a beautiful concert hall in Harlem, and it was a beautiful piano. And the only problem about recording there was the fact that the nearby church had the loudest bells. We had to stop recording at every hour. And actually, if there was a pause in the music at the quarter hour, we had to splice it out. So I mean, I liked the bells. I thought they should leave them in. But what I wanted to do is I felt that Schumann, when he edited his music later, almost all his piano music was written before he was 29. Mm-hmm. Then he would republish them when 10 years later. And he got frightened, I think, by some of the more audacious passages, and he sort of toned them down and did something much worse. He kept adding repeat signs that made it much longer and less interesting. And I wanted to record the original version, so I did one of the more unusual pieces of Schumann, the impromptus on a theme of Clara, which very rarely played in the original version, and the original version of the Kreisleriana, which is quite different, and of the Davidsbündler Tänze, which I think is Schumann's greatest masterpiece, along with the Fantasy, in the original version. And the Fantasy I recorded in the unpublished version of the manuscript in Budapest, and which I was sent a Xerox of. I didn't discover the manuscript, it was Alan Walker. But I was indignant with Alan Walker because there were 16 different measures in the thing, and he published 15 of them. So I had to get a Xerox to find out what something like that, or maybe it was 17 and 16. Anyway, I did that, and then I added two of the more revolutionary pieces of Schumann, which only exist in one version, which is the F sharp minor sonata and the Carnival. I think other people have played it that as well, but I mean, this is the first record of it, and that. It has an entirely different ending at the third movement. The end of the third movement goes back to the first movement. And he cut that out, and I think that's a mistake. He just added two bars of perfunctory arpeggios, and says, I prefer the original. I mean, there are a few details in the first and second movements which are quite different. So,
well, a man who is afraid of nothing that is audacious and has no need to tone anything down, Charles Rosen has been our guest last week and this week. In the spirit of the Elliot Carter piece 90+, I think we should wish you 80+, so that there will be many happy returns of your 80th birthday, and we hope many returns to Chicago to play music, to talk about music, and to talk with us here on the radio. Thank you so much.
It's been a great pleasure. Thank you.
Unfortunately, we are not able to bring you that recording of the original version of the Schumann Fantasy. We will bring it to you in the course of another edition of the program, but we'd like to play for you another favorite recording favorite of Charles Rosen himself and a favorite of others who listened to his recordings and to other recordings, the reminiscences of Don Juan of Franz Liszt. This is a fantasy created from and on the Mozart opera Don Giovanni, and it tells its own version of the story in a way that only Liszt could have done. It was written by Liszt for himself, and it is played here by Charles Rosen, a student of Moritz Rosenthal, who was, of course, a student of Franz Liszt himself. This is from a Music Master's release. The recording was made in 1993 at the American Academy of Arts and Letters, Uptown Manhattan, New York City.
Thank you.
Reminiscences of Don Juan by Franz Liszt in a performance recorded by Charles Rosen in 1993. Alternating music and conversation, as we like to do on Critical Thinking, we have a special opportunity that we can actually bring you an excerpt of a conversation between Charles Rosen and Elliot Carter. We spoke quite a bit last week with Mr. Rosen about Elliot Carter. This was a conversation recorded about 10 years ago, so Mr. Carter was only 88 or 89 then, and Mr. Rosen was a mere pup, a lad of 70. This is a recording put out by Bridge Records as a part of the Complete Music for Piano, a work that's title is already superfluous because Mr. Carter has written much music since 1997, 1998. But from that release by Bridge, a conversation between Elliot Carter and Charles Rosen.
The passage which I remember as being at this kind of recitative against slowly changing harmonies of a different rhythm is... very slow, soft harmonies changing constantly in the background against this very...
Well, you have that also in 90 Plus. There's the same sort of thing right at the beginning. It's something that interests me very much because I think that in a way this is the way we experience many things, the idea that there's one thing that comments on another constantly in our lives, in our music. And a lot of people at a concert are thinking about something else while Beethoven is being played, not putting that in the piece.
It is music for the modern world, quite clearly.
One tries to do it, of course. The modern world's having a hard time being modern.
Yes. These passages have always fascinated me in the music that you have two seemingly independent systems which are going along as if one wasn't paying any attention to the other, and yet, of course, they make very beautiful music together. The most spectacular example is the third quartet, which is really two duos playing an entirely different series of movements at the same time.
Yes, well, of course, they sound as if they are independent of each other, but they're really not. It's all carefully calculated. For instance, I try to avoid traffic jams and this kind of thing. I try to keep them one clear from the other. And then in the end, they all are concerned with the basic harmonic structure so that there's a sound pattern that unifies these diverse materials into one sound, and which I'm very concerned with. It may not be evident to the listener, but it's very evident to me.
Well, one of the most convincing things in your music is the harmony is very often calculated along with the rhythm. For example, I remember in the piano concerto that certain intervals like sixths, which are that sort of have a heavy slow motion, and minor seconds go much faster. So that
I also felt that in a case like that, each one of the intervals had its own character of feeling. Mm-hmm. And therefore, I tried to isolate different strands of music, not only by interval, but by rhythm, so that I tried to keep them separate so that you would hear one line like those six going up from the bass as a thing in itself, and this gives it a character and an identity of its own. I've tried to keep these different strands and different identities separate. For instance, at the opening of 90 Plus, there's a heavy chords and then there's single notes which are played against them in staccato against these held chords. And each one of them has a different type of playing. One, they're two different kinds of staccato, a longer sort of attack, and then the staccato attack against this. And I've tried to keep all that separate. And they also have different intervals melodically. But I must say that it's not easy for the poor pianist or the poor performer to keep all this separate.
It's fascinating.
It must be very confusing.
The one stumbling block that listeners find in your music, the problem is not what's there, is they expect something that isn't there. They expect to hear one kind of unified rhythm
that's going to give them a downbeat. And what happens is that you very often have contradictory rhythms with contradictory downbeats, and they keep listening for a downbeat. This particularly, I notice, true with orchestral pieces. They see the conductor's hand go down with a nice, what should be a thump, and they're not getting the thump, so that the a lot of music is made intelligible to an audience by the gestures of the conductor, and that's not going to work with your music. Because
Let me say that, of course, since I come from a generation of people who were very concerned with music before the Romantic and even before the Baroque period, when music was not measured out in bar lines the way it later became, and in music like Monteverdi and many madrigals, the conductor beats time, but there isn't a thump on the downbeat, the way that came to be, especially in German music and even in French music by the 17th and 18th century. Yeah. So that my music is really, a lot of it has been derived from a knowledge of music of the Renaissance and even before that. And in fact, there were even rhythmic experiments in those early days that were very influential in the early part of my music.
It's an old romantic dream. There is Schumann's review of Berlioz saying that, perhaps Berlioz is the man who will release us from the tyranny of the bar line, so that music should be produced like the nightingale who doesn't sing with bar lines. There's no conductor for the, And it is this idea of this kind of free developing rhythm in a way which you actually do start with the piano sonata and which then goes on to different forms of freely developing contradictory rhythms, and which makes the music so fascinating for us.
Let me say also that a part of this comes from having listened to jazz of that particular period of the 50s, in which there was a regular beat and then an improvisation against it, frequently not following the beat at all. Mm. And my music really has developed this idea to a much greater extent. It doesn't sound like jazz, but it really comes from this particular point of view. I remember hearing that even in the time of the waltz period, that waltzes were played that way. And I remember that my teacher, Nadia Boulanger, used to play examples of Chopin, the way Paderewski played it, and Paderewski kept the left hand very regular, which beat the time, and the right hand played in a much more improvisatory way, as if it was not connected directly with the rhythm.
Well, that is the old definition of rubato, that the left hand plays in time and the right hand deviates, and that's what Mozart used to play like that. It actually means that you're not playing with your hands together, but I mean, and that most people don't realize.
You see, what I'm doing is very old fashioned.
So, old bottles with new wine, or new bottles with old wine, or a little bit of both. 88-year-old Elliot Carter speaking with 69-year-old Charles Rosen in December of 1996, two New York natives who continue at 98 and 80 almost, respectively, to enrich our understanding of music and to enrich us with new music as well. Charles Rosen loves the music of Chopin, and he loves the music of Liszt. Let's hear him in a wonderful piece by Liszt, adapted from Chopin. Mr. Rosen says that this is one of the rare cases where a transcription exceeds, yet still respects the original. You can make up your mind about that. We opened the program with Chopin's Nocturne in D-flat major, Opus 27, number 2, and here is the song without words for piano, My Joys, by Liszt, based on that work of Chopin, Charles Rosen at the piano, recorded in 1993. Thank you. From the album on Music Masters Classics, The Romantic Generation, Charles Rosen performing the Chopin Liszt, or Liszt Chopin, My Joys, recorded in 1993. Well, it's been a joy to bring you all of this conversation and recorded playing with and by Charles Rosen. We want to thank Matt DeStefano for making this program sound great, as he always does. We'd like to thank Northeastern Illinois University for sharing Charles Rosen with us over these past couple of weeks. I'm Andrew Patner, your host and producer for this series. You can drop us a line, let us know what you thought of these or any of our other programs at Rentap, that's Patner spelled backwards, R-E-N-T-A-P, at AOL.com. Let's not forget our wonderful funders, Alpha Wood Foundation and Draupner LLC, a Chicago-based private equity firm, as well as other friends of this program. Thank you again for joining us, and we'll see you next week.